I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. This morning, Sly James' tenure as mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, ended with the swearing-in of his successor. During his 8 years in City Hall, James tackled a lot of issues, and they weren't all about downtown development. Today, the other side of the mayor's legacy, the people side. Those who worked with him will describe his commitment to the equity of women, early reading proficiency, and increasing the minimum wage. Then, abandoned homes are not an uncommon sight in Kansas City, especially east of Troost. Hear about the project that uses data to shed light on the problem by giving potential buyers a closer look at what those houses have to offer. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Well, let's talk about that legacy of now former Mayor Sly James of Kansas City. It obviously includes a new airport terminal and a highly successful streetcar line, but it also includes a whole lot more than that. Issues that haven't gotten as much attention, like advancing equity and opportunity for women, early reading proficiency, and boosting the minimum wage. Now a look back at some of the former mayor's achievements that don't qualify as brick-and-mortar projects. With us, Wendy Doyle's back. She's president and CEO of the Women's Foundation. Wendy, always good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
Mike English is back. He's executive director of Turn the Page KC. Mike, good morning to you.
Thank you, Steve.
And Terrence Wise is here. He's with Stand Up KC, the Fight for 15. That's the group pushing for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Terrence, nice to have you, too. Good morning.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, Mayor James Terrence has left City Hall for the last time as mayor, so there's been all kinds of talk about his legacy the past few weeks. I'm wondering from each of your viewpoints how you see it, and I'm not talking specifically about your particular issue, but a broader sense of how you think he should be remembered. Terrence, what do you think?
Well, you know, when it came to a movement of workers like in the Fight for 15 in a union, you know, I think it showed that Mayor Sly James supported a movement of workers. You know, whether you're black, white, gay, straight, native born, foreign, you're a worker in this city. And Mayor Sly James even told me that he recognized that it took a movement of workers that was going to get his attention and any elected leader's attention across the country.
Wendy, how about you?
I think one of his lasting legacies will be the work that he's done around women's empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not only the engagement of outside organizations, but it's really what he did to bring women's voices and viewpoints to the table to run effective government. And case in point, his chief of staff, Joni Wickham.
Mm-hmm. Who's by his side throughout his tenure as mayor. And you wondered at times, you know, the mayor could be a tough customer at times. That was quite an achievement that Joni pulled off there.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And one of the first women in that role.
Yeah.
And so that part is his lasting legacy from our perspective.
Yeah.
But also, he's done so much around the women's empowerment movement, whether it be from the paid family leave policies that he implemented for city employees more women on civic boards and commissions, moving the needle from 33% to 42% representation of our city, and then also workplace policies. So the When Work Works initiative, he really stood by our side to really encourage corporations in the city to look at that.
We're going to talk about all of that here this morning. Mike English, again, executive director of Turn the Page KC, the early reading initiative of the mayor's. From a broad standpoint, what do you think his legacy is?
I think it's been a real sense of urgency to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
He's brought a lot
That's a good word for him, I think.
Urgency, yeah, for sure, and boldness and a lot of Kansas City pride. And I think he's been really, really good at converting pride and enthusiasm from citizens and residents here into action. So he consistently challenges everyone, institutions and individuals, to help make the community better, whether it be in education or other areas as well.
You know, he could be an impatient man. No one would describe him as a pussycat. I mean, he really wanted to move things along, which is what you're saying here.
For sure.
Like.
And he took on some huge challenges. I mean, for example, third grade reading proficiency is not something that many mayors have taken on, but he was not afraid of that and was very impatient to get things done and actually see progress.
Terrence, is impatient a word you would associate with Mayor Sly James?
Definitely. And when I look back at history of this country, he was the first mayor to not only support $15 an hour across the country, but Kansas City was the first mayor under his leadership to nearly double the minimum wage here in Kansas City. So he moved quick, even on a national level, you know.
Okay. Well, let's turn to his legacy here, and I'll talk to each of you about some of the different issues we've highlighted already here today. Wendy Doyle, again, of the Women's Foundation, how will you remember him for his efforts at advancing equity and opportunity for women? You've mentioned that here this morning, but from a broad standpoint, you'd say what?
The Appointments Project is really a cornerstone of our work with the mayor and a lasting piece of his legacy. And as a result of that, that's an initiative led by the Women's Foundation, but he really took a chance on us, and we piloted the program with him.
Who started this project? Did he come to you? Did you go to him? How did
we
that
went
work?
To him. We had commissioned a research study with University of Kansas. What are the barriers for women to become civically engaged? Mm-hmm. And that research study led us to a solution of the Appointments Project. That study showed that the number one reason is women want to be asked to serve in some capacity, and they don't think about giving back to their city in that capacity.
They don't put themselves forward. They wait to be invited.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they don't think about, hey, I could give back by becoming civically engaged, by serving my city in a volunteer capacity. So he really stepped up. We shared that with him. He immediately said yes, his tenacity.
I was going to say that this is a man who is sort of geared to think along the lines of women's equity anyway, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. This was, you know, fit right in nicely with his women's initiative, which to our knowledge is about the first in the country. And this is something that he spearheaded, kind of a broad campaign for the city that he implemented. And the Appointments Project fit nicely in that. But he took a chance on us, and we had no, outcomes to show for it, but he believed in us and the opportunity. And as a result of that, that program now is in 29 different municipalities, Missouri and Kansas, and in 3 states.
No kidding. And you're saying that he moved the needle in terms of the percentage of women serving on Kansas City boards and commissions from what to what, roughly?
From 33% when we started the initiative in 2014 to today to 42%.
So you're nearing 50%.
Nearing 50%, absolutely.
Is that the target? Is that the goal of the initiative?
Yes. Our initiative really wants to be reflective of the population. So 51% of the population represents women, and that's our objective. And all women of all backgrounds and all parts of the city is the objective.
You know, he also worked to create something called the Women's Empowerment Initiative. What is the Women's Empowerment Initiative, Wendy?
This was a campaign that he was his brainchild along with Chief of Staff Joni Wickham. And it was really for him to engage organizations to be a part of moving the needle for more women to become engaged in the city. And Central Exchange was part of that, UMKC's Women's Council. And we all had projects. Women's Foundation certainly was a part of that. Our project we brought to the table was the Appointments Project.
Mm-hmm. He didn't stop there. He expanded parental leave for city workers. Why was that important?
Very important. The first city in the country to step forward and initiate that. The first city. So he was a real leader in that capacity. 6 weeks off for the birth or adoption of a child for city employees. He then came back a year later and extended that to 7 weeks. So really a leader.
So how much of an expansion in time was that from what it was before he came into office?
There was nothing. And you had to, you know, use your sick time, your paid time off, your vacation time for the birth or adoption of a child. And he said, no, we can do better. It fits nicely with the, his focus on children. And so he stepped forward as a leader and initiated that.
You know, he partnered with your foundation to create something called When Work Works, an initiative that provides benchmarking to businesses and rates them in the areas of workplace flexibility, paid leave policies and more. How important was that?
Very important. And this is a national competition. So companies apply and then are benchmarked against others across the country. And then there's award ceremony. And it was really encouraging so that it's a good, kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval for when new employees are looking at, hey, do I want to go work for this company? When you see that award, you know that that is a family-friendly workplace organization. So he really stepped forward with us, and we launched that together.
You know, Wendy, I'm not sure if this is the most important thing he did, but it's got to rank right up there. He also teamed with the American Association of University Women and the Women's Foundation to launch AAUW Work Smart KC to help close the gender pay gap with salary and benefits negotiating training. How important was that?
Very important. And again, a leader in the country. The only other city that had really leaned in, it was Boston. And certainly we want to exceed what our peers are doing in another city. So we brought that together here to the Heartland with the goal of trying to train in Missouri and Kansas 1 million women in 5 years. And the goal of that is just for women to build confidence, to be able to lean in and close that pay gap.
What do you say when you want more money? You think you're not being paid as much as your male counterparts.
Exactly. And this provides the tools, free training. It's web-based free training on negotiating, researching, and giving you the tools and confidence to be able to ask for that pay raise or to negotiate a good starting salary.
So this was not a mayor who took one bite of the apple when it comes to women's equity. We're talking multiple steps.
Multiple steps, and always open to ideas on what could fall under this women's empowerment umbrella. So very entrepreneurial, very much a leader, and always willing to lean in.
And it sounds like from your standpoint, this legacy for women's equity might be as enduring as anything else he's done.
Absolutely. We see it as lasting, very profound, and it will go down in history as one of the big things that he accomplished.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about Mayor Sly James' legacy, maybe not from the brick and mortar standpoint, but for some other aspects that he might be known for. Let's turn to Terrence Wise here with Stand Up KC, the minimum wage initiative. To what extent was Mayor James an ally in the fight for the higher minimum wage, Terrence?
Well, you know, when we nearly doubled the minimum wage in City Hall back a few years ago, we won by a vote of 12-1 from City Council. And we know City Council never votes 12-1 on anything. So we were happy to see that, only to see it taken away by legislature in Jeff City. But to see Mayor Sly James act in such a manner, and not only that, be on strike lines with workers, physically be present. He's been at celebration dinners we've had here to celebrate successes in the movement. You know, just he's got a place in our heart and the movement's heart as well.
You're talking about the action the city council took to actually raise the minimum wage dramatically, but then the state legislature in Jefferson City said, oh, hang on a minute, you can't raise a minimum wage in one city independently like that. We've got to sign off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in a place in this country where we've been divided, you know, as the working class across the spectrum, just to see Mayor Sly James standing with us, knowing that it's going to take a movement to win women's equity, pay equity, any kind of equality in our city.
You know, Terrence, at one point he opposed the council's ordinance to raise Kansas City's minimum wage, saying it had to be a statewide initiative, I think, to overcome the General Assembly's opposition to what Kansas City was doing. What was your reaction to that?
Well, you know, as a movement and me personally, we know that it's going to take pressure, and more pressure to get anything done. And workers in this city, imagine a day like today, how hot it is outside. We camped on the steps of City Hall for a week. Not only did we pinch tents, we fasted, you know, to put pressure on the mayor and city council to get it done. And we were not only happy to win that 12-1 vote, but also have it go to a vote here in Kansas City where voters had a chance to go to the ballot box and vote and see 72% of Kansas Cityans come out in support of 15. You know, we knew that as a movement, we had to have a plan.
So you're not at $15 an hour now. Where are you? Remind us.
Well, I'm at $12 an hour now. And, you know, when people ask my salary, it's $12 an hour. I'm a McDonald's manager. I work at McDonald's here in Kansas City. But we know minimum wage in this city is not at 15. And workers, over half of Kansas City wakes up making less than 15. We know that 15 is achievable, not only here in Kansas City, where according to MIT, the living wage is $23 an hour.
Explain what the living wage is.
That's for one adult and one child here in this city. To raise that, you would have to make $23 an hour. And that's here in Kansas City, not L.A., not New York. That's our zip code.
So that's a near doubling of where the minimum wage is today, Terrence. So you're saying this fight for a higher minimum wage has a long ways to go.
Oh, yeah. We said it in the beginning. 15 is not the ceiling. It's the floor.
The city program that recognizes businesses who do pay the higher wage voluntarily, Terrence, did that get the attention of any employers in the city and get them to consider what they pay?
Well, you know, there are good business owners who know that 15 is not only good for Kansas City, it's good for the economy. You give workers like me money, I'm not going to sit on it. I'm going to go out and buy my kids' shoes. I'm going to go
back into
the
economy is your
definitely
point. Yeah. And how many businesses actually went to $15 an hour?
Well, we know that major corporations like Amazon, Target, you know, have lifted their wages to 15.
So,
and many more should follow suit as well.
You know? Okay. Well, let's turn to literacy here and turn the page, KC, Mike. And where does the mayor's passion for early reading proficiency come from?
Well, you know, I think he saw how integrated reading proficiency is with many other factors the city has to deal with. So crime, economic development, these are all issues that are impacted by third grade reading proficiency. I think early on he started to understand where we stood as a city. When he took office, only about a third of our kids were reading proficiently by the end of third grade, which was very striking to him. And if, when you're talking about eight-year-old children, that's that whose futures in a way are already determined, that's appalling. And so the mayor really decided he wanted to help do something about that to support schools.
Mm-hmm.
And to support schools, he wanted to mobilize the entire Kansas City community. So that's why he created Turn the Page KC as an entity. And now we are a nonprofit organization that mobilizes the community to support schools to improve third grade reading proficiency.
I want you to cite that stat again. You're saying that the reading proficiency of kids, third graders in Kansas City, one-third can read at a third-grade level at the end of third grade.
Yeah, that's gone up.
One-third.
So it was one-third back in 2013. It's getting closer to 50% now. So across the city of Kansas City, Missouri, not only is it increasing, but the difference between our city and the rest of the state, that gap is closing. So we're going in the right direction, but still less than half of our kids are reading proficiently by the end of third grade. And think back to when you were a fourth grader, Steve, and you were trying to understand social studies or science or math.
I was having a real hard time understanding social studies in fourth grade.
Well, yeah. And to do so without being able to read fluently and comprehend what you're reading is very, very challenging. And so it's no surprise that kids that are not reading proficiently at that age start to struggle in school, start to fall behind, act out, and ultimately drop out of school.
Let me give you a chance to toot your own horn and the horn of your organization. To what extent did Turn the Page KC help raise that proficiency level from 33% to 50%?
Well, you know, our organization, what we call ourselves a collective impact organization, and what that means is we are responsible for aligning a lot of different initiatives, encouraging collaboration. But I think what I'm most proud of what we've done is to really identify obstacles to kids reading proficiently and help schools and help the community to bring in new programs where necessary. One of those programs is called the Literacy Lab, which is a K-3 tutoring program that we helped to bring to Kansas City. And now there are about 50 tutors in schools. Lead to Read KC is a volunteer program that places over 1,000 volunteers reading to kids weekly in school. And so Mayor James, every time he talked about third grade reading proficiency. He would encourage people sign up to be a volunteer, actually get into a school building and help do something about this reading crisis.
You know, it's interesting. It always struck me that he didn't take on anything sort of half-baked. Like his work with the Women's Foundation, like his work with the minimum wage, he was really committed to this early reading idea.
Absolutely. You know, I think he sees all of the kids in Kansas City as his kids. Whether mm-hmm. they be in the Liberty School District, the Hickman Mills School District, the Kansas City Public School District. So he really took that responsibility pretty seriously. And think about, he has visited every elementary school in the city. There are about 100 elementary schools.
Wow.
And he's visited all of those and read to kids at those schools and talked to the teachers in those schools. So probably nobody else in our city has done that. And the fact that the mayor of the city has done that speaks volumes.
He's going to continue as chairman of the board of this organization. Do I have that right?
That's right, yeah. So he had the foresight to take this idea, which was his, turn the page KC, and to essentially spin it out of City Hall into a nonprofit organization back in 2014. And so as such, we have a board of directors, and he's our board chair and will continue to be our board chair.
He's not going away.
No, I hope not. He said I bet he'll spend even more time on it now that he's no longer the mayor.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. The legacy of outgoing Mayor Sly James. That was the voice of Mike English, Executive Director of Turn the Page KC. We also heard from Wendy Doyle, President and CEO of the Women's Foundation, and Terrence Wise, who's with Stand Up KC, the Fight for 15. Thank you all for a good conversation. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with a new initiative at UMKC that helps to deal with blight in the urban core. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We are back. I am Steve Kraske. You listen to me on the radio and you follow me on social media. Now you can get a weekly newsletter too at kcur.org/Kraske. You can sign up to receive exclusive content from me in your inbox, along with stories and highlights from the up-to-date team each week. That's kcur/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, Kansas City's music scene seems to keep growing. We'll look at the best local bands and solo artists from the first half of the year, as well as some national and global acts. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, abandoned homes are a big problem in these parts, especially in the eastern parts of Kansas City. The problem with them, they result in neighborhoods hollowed out from the inside. Professors at the University of Missouri, Kansas City have taken aim at the problem with a new initiative called Abandoned to Vibrant. The idea is to give potential buyers of abandoned homes a fuller picture of the home and its neighborhood. The goal is to get those homes back into the hands of actual homeowners. But researchers have also found that as the pace of buying many of these homes has increased, that a lot of the buyers are from outside of Kansas City, even as far away as Dubai, Europe, and Australia. Joining us now are two UMKC professors who are behind the Abandoned to Vibrant project. They are Jim DeLisle. He's Director of Academic Real Estate Programs and Associate Professor of Real Estate at UMKC. Jim, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Brent Nevers is also here. He's an Associate Professor of Public Affairs at UMKC. Brent, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Jim, why is it so important to get abandoned homes back into the hands of real people who actually own them?
Well, the abandoned housing issue is one that's very pervasive across the country, and especially here in Kansas City. The importance is creating neighborhood vitality and vibrancy and creating an environment where things are happening, where people can connect with their neighbors, etc. And I think it's important, if you think about abandoned housing, getting it back into productive use is one option. The alternative is demolition. And demolition transfers an abandoned property project problem to a vacant lot problem, mm-hmm. which is even more problematic in many cases. So creating opportunities for people to use sweat equity to get back into home ownership and to revitalize neighborhoods is really important.
Brent, is the problem in Kansas City with abandoned homes bigger than other cities, or is our problem more pronounced somehow?
Yeah, certainly. We're part of these shrinking cities or legacy cities. These are communities that are really across the country dealing with these issues. The difference about Kansas City is we're not a shrinking city. We're not Flint or Detroit or Toledo. What we are growing neighborhoods and shrinking neighborhoods. And we really have to think through, as Kansas City, how we address neighborhoods that are going through these shrinking sort of phases.
You know, Brent, how many abandoned homes do we have in this city?
That's a great question. So we've heard numbers between 10,000 and 12,000.
I was going to say.
But one of the exciting things we're doing at UMKC is starting this conversation about how we can use imaging technology to identify homes that are abandoned. One of the real problems is we have these lists. They're 2-3 years old. We don't know if that's actually the case anymore or not, especially as the market has gotten so vibrant. We don't know if that house is flipped or not from these lists. So we're working on these exciting initiatives with cameras to be able to identify immediately when a house flips.
So what's the objective here, Jim? What are you trying to do?
What we're trying to do is to help the land bank achieve its mission, which is dual, getting properties back in the tax roll, but also providing accessible housing. So the Kansas City, Missouri Land Bank is a third-generation land bank that has that dual economic purpose and a social purpose. And what we found in dealing with when we started this in 2016, there were about 600 or so sold properties. About two-thirds of those were sold to people who were coming in with sweat equity to build a house to come into a neighborhood.
Right.
The other third or so were built by investors who were not necessarily flipping the properties, but bringing them up and renting them out to homeowners, in some cases selling them.
So you guys have a website, and on the website there's more information about these properties that's aimed at what encouraging potential home buyers to take a hard look at them, right?
Yes, Steve. This was a beta test of the website. And what we were trying to do is, if you think about it, we already have marginalized people economically. And so getting the right place to make an investment for their future is important. And so what we tried to do is take advantage of the open data portal in Kansas City and pull in crime data and property violations and 311 calls, other indicators of neighborhood health, so that a potential buyer could look at different options to buy and not only look at the house itself and the condition it's in, but the surrounding environs to make a decision, is that where I want to make my future?
So Brent, before I forget, what is the website?
So it's called A2V, Abandoned to Vibrant. And we'll certainly have that out there for people to see.
In A2V.com?
A2V. It's a longer website.
We'll put the link on our website later on today. Yeah,
absolutely. But what I would like to say, what really got me interested in this was a story about land banks. And here in Kansas City, the director of the land bank talked about the fact that a lot of immigrant families were buying land bank homes. And part of the process is within 120 days, you have to clear any property violations, bring it up to code. Flippers are very good at understanding how to do this, but you have these new families trying to climb that ladder of the American dream. What was happening was they weren't pulling permits. They weren't understanding what kind of home they were buying. And, you know, whereas that great American dream story really turned into a very negative story of having after 120 days or thereafter having the land bank having to take that home back from them after they've sunk, you know, some of their money.
Because they didn't really understand what they were buying here. They thought they were getting a house at a great price, and it wasn't much of a house. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly it. So just as we see Zillow, we go on, we search around. They have all sorts of nice graphics about what's going on in the neighborhood. You know, we wanted to create a website that was like that, you know, Zillow for distressed houses, so that you can have a much better idea about what you're getting yourself into.
Jim, how are you getting the word out to these communities so that folks can understand and access the site to really understand what kind of house they might be purchasing here?
Well, we've been working with the Code for KC Brigade, who does volunteer work on bringing technology to bear on issues, working with some of the other classes in our law school and the business school where we're sensitizing students to some of the issues, but also working with some of the neighborhoods and trying to bring more information to them so they understand what is available. There's been an explosion of public information, the open data portals, et cetera, but very few people have been able to process that into information and make it something that you can see. If you just have numbers of crime, but you don't see the trend in crime, it doesn't really tell you things.
So if you go to this site, what kinds of big data information can anyone sort of glean from looking at the site?
Well, you can look at the site, you can select a property in the land bank, And then you look at either a tenth of a mile surrounding what the conditions are in terms of crime trends, property violations, 311 calls, or you can click on the neighborhood link and you do the same thing where we're showing people what's going on around them. And if you think about it, in buying your own house, you probably didn't have access to this kind of information.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is bring data down to information for people who are marginally economically survivable, if you will, in the city in terms of buying houses, and try to help them make a proper selection.
And Brent, that's important because, as you pointed out, there are a couple of deadlines that new homeowners face here when they buy these abandoned properties. You mentioned one to 120 days in. Isn't there a second one, like a year in, where you've got to pay back to, or I don't know what the deal is. Yeah.
So it's 120 days in. The land bank goes in, makes sure that you've cleared up the various code violations. And then at a three-year point also, they come back and reinspect to make sure that you're keeping up the property. What happens actually is the land bank does extend these deadlines quite frequently for families who are having trouble making those deadlines. Clearly, the land bank is here for a social mission and an economic mission. So they certainly don't want to take back a home from a family who's trying to make it right. At the same time, there is code that they have to follow, and this is the timeline that they have.
Sounds like really can be tricky stuff at times with the land banks up against, because you want to keep those homes in the hands of people who can benefit from it. Yeah. And so there's also this sort of issue that's come up where you guys have found that a number of people who are buying these properties are, in fact, doing it as investment properties, Jim. You have investors from as far away as Dubai buying homes on Kansas City's east side, abandoned homes. What are you finding there, and how big of a concern should this be?
Well, Steve, actually, the land bank is selling primarily to local players.
Okay.
From the state and or city area, because they go through a vetting process. So if you think about it, a land bank buyer has to come in with a budget to talk about what it would take to bring the property up to code. And the land bank actually has their own budget. They compare the two to make sure that people know what they're getting into, like you talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But what we found is that there's almost a 20% withdrawal rate where somebody signed up to buy a land bank property, then pulled back. That's among people buying it to build and to live in. The default rate or withdrawal rate for people who are rehabbers is about less than 5%.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a learning curve, and what we're trying to do is figure out what lessons learned from the rehabbers who have experience and access to capital and or providers of different services, and pass that on into potential buyers so they know what they're getting into.
Jim, is it necessarily a bad thing to have rehabbers buying these homes who can fix them up and then resell, or is that a problem because they resell at a market price point that maybe the neighborhood really can't support?
Well, these properties, if you think about it, Steve, it takes 3 years to go to the land bank. 3 years in property arrears, vacant property violations. So these houses are pretty run down, and many are in run down neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about the alternative is tearing it down and having an empty lot where the grass isn't mowed, et cetera. It's a better alternative to get somebody in living in the property and perhaps owning the property and or renting the property.
Mm-hmm.
So getting it more productive use and provide affordable housing for people, I think that's the important.
Brent, do I understand correctly here that the number of abandoned homes in Kansas City has declined, at least from the past few years? What's the trend out there, and why is it happening?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things is that the city publishes what's called a demolish list. So these are homes that are dangerous and need to be demolished, partly out of a city tax that we've used for 6-7 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And the really fascinating thing for us is that people are buying houses off the demolish list. So there's such demand out there for housing in some of these neighborhoods that people are saying, yeah, I'm going to take a risk on this one. This one is so dangerous. The city has said it has to come down, and a buyer says, no, I'll take it. So this is a tremendous change. Jim and I started this project 3 years ago, where the land bank had a huge surplus, you know, 1,500 homes that it could not move. We're at a time now where they're moving houses. As soon as they come in, they go straight out the door.
Because investors see potential here.
Exactly.
So help me understand, is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing?
It's a thing. what I'll
spoken
say.
Spoken like a true academic, which I happen to be one, by the way.
Absolutely. No, yeah. It's really, it's just so nuanced, and I understand in the political sphere, we have to have, you know, linear kind of straight answers. But frankly, nobody wants to live on a block where somebody has a house that's really blighted. Nobody wants that. Also, nobody necessarily wants a family coming in who might not understand the neighborhood, might not care about the history, and who lives in the neighborhood. So, you know, to say that it's unvarnished one way or the other is kind of tough. At the same time, we have to talk about this. And the problem is our political dialogue is two steps behind the market. The market's already flipped.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to run as hard as possible to catch up with that political dialogue.
Well, maybe the magic question here then, given that today we have a new mayor in Kansas City, Quentin Lucas, Jim, who's made it one of his priorities is affordable housing. Is what we're seeing happening out there with this decline in stock and abandoned homes, does that portend maybe a potential solution to the affordable housing problem that's so acute here in Kansas City?
Well, part of the problem with affordable housing and the land bank inventory is that those houses are dwindling. They're less than, they're about 156 out of 1,000 properties that were residential properties that could have been sold have been sold. Mm-hmm. And so we're running out of inventory. I think probably the biggest challenge we're going to face is what to do with these vacant lots. Many of them are very narrow and they aren't suitable for the current housing codes, et cetera.
Are you guys going to keep track of those as well now?
Yes, and I think that's a very serious problem. And nobody's figured out what to do with those because the economics of building new don't pencil out. We're talking maybe $100,000, $120,000 to build a house in a distressed neighborhood. The rents and or the income in the neighborhood wouldn't support that. So there needs to be something with the new mayor, a sort of a policy with affordable housing to bridge that gap, to make things accessible to people in the environs and locations where they really want to live.
So the hope is here, Jim, that you all can help the new mayor, the new city council, with some stats and some numbers about what exactly they're up against out there.
Yes, and I think the more that we can do things that are sort of data-driven, people use that term, but what we've done in some work we did with Legal Aid is we looked at before and after an intervention, and we actually saw a change in the number of crimes and property violations, et cetera.
So it went down.
Went down.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we want to do, Steve, is get ahead of the curve and be able to develop predictive models, which is what we're talking about with our colleagues and some new work that we're doing, to be able to identify a property before it becomes abandoned and before it impacts so that we can intervene and create and stop the curve from declining.
Sounds like important work. Again, the initiative is called Abandoned to Vibrant. We'll put the website up on our website later on today. I want to thank our guests. You just heard Jim Delisle, director of the Academic Real Estate Program and associate professor of real estate at UMKC, along with Brent Never, his colleague and associate professor of public affairs at UMKC. Thanks for your good work. Thanks for coming in and sharing your views. We sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Coming up, a new look weekend to-do list. You just got to hear that refrain there from Peter Frampton. Brian McTavish is here to talk about some cool stuff to do on this weekend. He's joined by a new partner, Spencer Hardwick. Spencer, welcome to you. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Steve. Great to be with you guys.
Brian, take it away. Peter Frampton's going to be in town on Monday.
He is. Hi, Spencer. So
good to be working with you too, Brian.
It's a beautiful thing. All right, Peter Frampton. It's the farewell tour. Let's get the opening act out of the way. We'll not go back to it. We'll just focus on Peter at 7:30 Monday at Starlight Theater. Opening that wonderful show is Jason Bonham's Led Zeppelin.
Wow.
That's the son of John Bonham, the famous Led Zeppelin drummer. So that's a great way to open the show, 7:30 Monday at Starlight Theater. Now.
Yes, now.
1976. Well,
yes,
let's see.
I was there.
America's Bicentennial, you
Spencer
were there.
Spencer wasn't, but we
I
were.
Was not, no.
No. Spencer was not yet.
I'm checking Wikipedia right now.
1976. Also, Jimmy Carter was elected president. But I'll always remember the summer of 1976 because it was the summer of Frampton Comes Alive.
And it's hard to believe how big that album was.
Let's believe
at the time.
It. Let's make it real. It's the Superstar Making Double Life album by Peter Frampton. It became the best-selling live album in history.
Yes.
Up to that time, 43 years later, Steve and Spencer, it's still the number four best-selling
Is that right?
Ever. Wow. So here's the scoop. The ace English guitarist, Peter Frampton, is quitting regular touring.
I saw that.
Due to his advancing health problem. Yeah. It's called inclusion body myositis. It's an autoimmune disease that weakens and atrophies muscles in the legs, arms, and hands. We wish him well. And you know who else is wishing him well? Clearly, audiences and critics. They are loving this tour. He is playing the same guitar he played on Frampton Comes Alive. Do yourself a favor. Go back to 1976 land.
Just on Monday.
On Monday.
Imagine yourself in my shoes, close your eyes and get up in here. And picture how it feels to be a king for a minute. Now feel it. Porsches, Benzes, pounds is endless. It's never hard to tell who my crew of Trism Men's is. Players, Pepsi, and dimes all around. Plus Italian suits cut and shines by the pound. I'm down for your crew.
Spencer Hardwick, is that the voice of Shaq?
Shaquille
O'Neal?
It is. I was actually going to ask you guys for a pop quiz, and it was going to be, who do you think this is? And hint, it's not a rapper, but it is Shaquille O'Neal.
Okay. Wow. He's going to be here.
He is going to be.
All so 7 foot, 19 of them, or whatever he is.
Exactly. 7 foot, two, I think, something crazy.
Something crazy.
He used to be a rapper in the 90s, and he had a very lucrative professional career playing basketball, but now he's coming back to Power and Light on Friday at 6 p.m. to do DJing. He's going to have a few other DJs with him. He's doing this all across the country, and this has generated quite a bit of intrigue online. So it'll be really interesting to see what Shaq is doing in Kansas City. He was at the Big 3 basketball tournament last week, so to see him here spinning records is going to be a little bit different.
Does he have a special DJ name?
I think it's Diesel, and that goes with the name he used to call himself when he was on the court. So it's DJ Diesel,
yes,
and he's got a few others with him whose names I don't remember off the top of my head, but all will be available tomorrow at 6 p.m. Power and Light.
Do they reinforce the floor because he weighs so much and is so big? Yeah, they should think about it. Just a little tip from Steve-O. Yeah. What do we have here, Brian?
Okay, we all want to be a teenage idol.
Yes, we do.
Well, we do. You said that rather
matter-of-factly. I did. I'm not sure. I can't be a teenage idol anymore.
You can be whatever you want to be this weekend. Okay, so here we go. It's Shuttle Rock. It's the Teen Battle of the Bands from 6 to 9 Friday at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Here's what you get, and here's what you ought to go do. Six local teen rock bands vie for $500.
Hmm.
And I would say not inconsequential bragging rights. Plus, there's a headlining set by last year's Teen Battle of the Bands winner, quite frankly, the band. So, here's what it will happen. You will get, in alphabetical order, these teen bands. They all want to be famous. They're already teenagers. Presumably, other teenagers will cheer them on.
Yes.
So, here are the bands. Amalgam, Dopamine, Formalities, The Shoes. There's actually another new wave band called The Shoes, but I'm saying the local Shoes probably know that.
Can we do a show sometime on the names of bands?
Yes.
Yes.
We could do it right now, but it might be awkward. Okay, two more bands. There's Three Infinity and Yellow House, and plus, quite frankly, the band they will headline. Now, who picks the winner? Well, judges will include members of the Nelson Atkins Teen Council and members of, quite frankly, the band. They should know. They won last year, plus perhaps the most important element, audience response. Do not underestimate the power of your lungs to tip the balance. That will happen Friday night at the Nelson Atkins.
Clap your hands, everybody, if you got what it takes. Because I'm Curtis Blow, and I want you to know that these are the Breaks.
It's Spencer Hardwick, tell us about Breakin' Art, this event coming up this weekend.
Absolutely. So we're all pretty familiar with Curtis Blow and the Breaks. So now we're talking about Breakin'
Art. Are we familiar with Curtis Blow and the Breaks?
Oh, I hope some of our listeners are.
I'm going to get
there.
That's
something
there.
I don't need
Wikipedia fast.
Absolutely. So if you go down to River Market on Friday, 6 to 8:30 p.m., you can also see graffiti, mural arts, and live breakdancing. So a nice little taste of hip-hop culture. I'm curious to know whether either of you have ever done breakdancing.
Huh.
I'm guessing that's a no.
Let me put it to you this way. Now, here's the question for me. Here's the question. Have you ever thought about breakdancing?
I would break if I danced like that.
No, exactly.
Yeah. Breaking hips. Got it. Okay.
Sounds like fun, though.
Okay. Whether a villain or a superstar, I'm cosplaying just for me. Knife, sword, armor, staff, lightsaber, what will I bring? What do we have here, Brian McTavish?
Once again, costume play, better known as cosplay, is seemingly everywhere, including at Nerdlesque Festival. That's Nerdlesque. It's a combo Comic-Con and Burlesque Fest.
Oh, my.
That is indeed. It's a double my. It welcomes nerd-friendly people, maybe even actual nerds, who will cosplay. You must be ages 18 and up because it's spicy cosplay. Performances and workshops are tonight through Saturday at the Just Off Broadway Theater. If you're not quite ready to self-identify as a fun-loving adult nerd, now would be a good time to try it, because every event, if you walk in costume, you could win a walk-in contest award. But tonight, Friday and Saturday night, there's all kinds of stuff on stage at the Just Off Broadway Theater, as well as workshops, including Slayage 101. That's where you kill it on stage as a Nerdlesque performer.
Slayage 101?
Slayage 101. Not to mention Bump and Grind 101, but that kind of speaks for itself.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, no.
So you have to take a class how to do that?
Well,
that came to me naturally.
I would. Now, I might take Bump and Grind. I think I could simulate that. The breakdance,
oh my,
probably not going to happen. But that's why we have breakdancers, right?
You
could actually do breakdancing on stage at Nerdlesque Festival if you wanted.
Okay, and finally today. But now I'm the champion on the tailgate scene. 8 bags, 2 boards, 2 holes, that's all I need. What do we have here, Spencer?
So this game goes by a lot of different names: backyard toss, bags, bag-o, chucko, cornhole. So
it's on TV now. There's national competitions.
ESPN, the Ocho.
Nothing simple anymore.
Not at all. And so, big game for a tailgating city like ours. So out at the Hy-Vee Arena, which is a really cool space that folks need to check out, 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. I believe it's on Saturday. There'll be a bags toss tournament. So if you and your friends feel like you're ready to go move from beyond the tailgate to actually winning some money and getting a little prestige, head on over to Hy-Vee Arena this weekend. It's going to be a good time.
Play some cornhole. Can't go wrong playing cornhole. That's Spencer Hardwick. That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yesterday on the show, we were live in Linwood, Kansas, as officials and residents told us about getting hit by an EF4 tornado in May. No thanks, and how they are recovering. Hear that in other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Monday on the show, meet the architect whose view on design expanded after losing his sight. You can find Spencer Hardwick, by the way, his blog, The Wire KC. Find out events he's talking about this weekend. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.